Whistleblowers clash with anti-Carl protesters in New York City. The parade, which was billed as a celebration of our new place in the universe, broke down into chaos when blocked by protesters. Kyle Stafford, at Kyle Stafford. At AP, what the fuck are they thinking, celebrating after everything that was done to us? They're lucky no one drove a Dodge Challenger into them. Altus, at Altus Labs. We are hiring. We have dozens of positions open right now. This is your chance to make the future. Altus.net/make the future.
Miranda. I do not have the temperament to be a secret agent. I hate stress. I hate it so much that it makes me extremely productive, because I will work any amount necessary to make stress go away. But that was the thing. The existence of Altus was stress for me. Every minute of the day, there was a little ache in my brain, and every time I checked to see what it wasn't worry about my experiments or about whether I'd said something dumb to a lab mate. It was always only Altus. It was like a grain of sand in my heart. And when something is stressing me out, I have to do something about it. I have to at least feel like I'm trying. That was one of the worst parts of April disappearing. I kept feeling like I had to solve the problem. Unfortunately, you can't solve someone being dead. But I could at least start on the problem of Altus. The stress was coming from two places. First, Peter Petrowicki was succeeding. Bad people shouldn't get power. And he was getting more and more of it. I wasn't even so much worried about what he was going to do with the power. I was too caught up in the fact that he was getting it. But I probably would have been able to ignore that eventually, because it's not like I had to look at Peter Petrowicki all day. I did, however, have to look at rat brains all day and think about the fact that right now in Puerto Rico, a bunch of people were working on science that would almost definitely make my research completely obsolete. And that was my second source of stress, eating away at me and getting worse every day. I was getting snappy with people, and my stomach was always a little upset. Professor Lundgren kept telling me all research is supposed to be additive, and that science doesn't actually work in breakthroughs the way we're all taught. She could say that, but I couldn't believe it. If the service they were going to provide included some high-bandwidth neural link, they were decades ahead of our lab. So what was the point of my thesis? What was the point of driving head down every day through piles of mind-numbing data entry to build something that might, in 6 months, look like an Apple II? That's when I started looking at Altus job postings. Junior scientist, biomicrofabrication, Puerto Rico. State-of-the-art research lab is seeking an R&D chemical and materials scientist to relocate to Puerto Rico. Our lab is pushing the boundaries of what is possible, and this is your chance to make the future. We're looking for an energetic, resourceful chemist and/or materials scientist with experience in experimental design and expertise in organic, polymer, and analytical chemistry. A passion for what's next is a must. Team players only. Now I just had two problems. One, I was qualified for this job, but not tremendously. They were probably looking for a postdoc candidate, though the fact that they didn't say so was promising. It was also telling. They might not be being picky because of how fast they were hiring. Two, my name was Miranda Beckwith, and I couldn't change that. Most people wouldn't recognize me. But the moment some recruiter Googled my name, they would see that I was friends with April May. The nice thing was that, with some time separating me from my initial find of the article, I was less angry and a little more calculating. I started thinking, well, this probably won't work anyway. Might as well give it a try. It felt like doing something. I remember the day I sent the application in because I was also distracting myself from the other piece of stress that I definitely couldn't do anything about. It was the one-year anniversary of the Carls, and of me sending my first email to April. Everyone was using it as an opportunity to shout at each other. The Defenders didn't exist anymore, but all of the people who were sympathetic to them still did. And the arguments were never really about Carl anyway. Even with them gone, pundits were getting powerful by arguing that we needed to be more afraid. It felt like the public was only getting angrier every day. A group of people had decided to have a Carl parade in New York, and it was cute. But then it was blocked by protesters, and the whole thing fell apart. Twitter then got very angry on absolutely everyone's behalf. The whole thing made me feel sick. Maybe I even knew that the chances of something going more wrong were higher than usual. We were all a little on edge. So instead of looking at angry people calling out racism and xenophobia from citizens, pundits, and politicians alike, I guiltily scrubbed references to April and the Somme from my social media profiles, spruced up my LinkedIn, and wrote up a cover letter. As months passed after the Carls disappeared, that's how everyone thought about it. Though for us, of course, it was also the time since April died. I kept feeling more and more like my time with April, Andy, Maya, and Robin was some kind of other life that I hadn't really belonged in. My brain did a fairly good job of convincing me that I wasn't actually an important part of the group. This is just imposter syndrome, of course, and I know it is. But that didn't stop me from believing it. I mean, I built the Somme. I know I did that. I also know that very little of the code was mine. And there were way too many people working on that project for anyone to claim credit. And my brain also told me that being basically a high-level employee did not mean those people were actually my friends. They were obviously too cool for that. And if I looked back, there were plenty of examples of them, by which I mostly mean April, not treating me super well. Yeah, I knew a lot about things that April and Maya and Andy didn't know about, but they knew things about themselves and about culture. I can tell you all about how valence electrons affect conductivity, but I didn't even know I was queer until I hooked up with April. I didn't even know I was queer after I hooked up with April. I thought maybe it was just that she was famous and cool and I wasn't really sexually attracted to her, just to who she was. April and Maya had known so much about themselves and about how to imagine the world. This is maybe going to sound gross, but I was envious of them and mad at myself for not spending more time trying to figure out who I was. I'd just gone with what I looked like and what people expected, and assumed that since I was attracted to guys, I was straight. How could a person unfamiliar with her own sexual orientation possibly be cool enough to be in April May's inner circle? I'm trying to show you how good my brain was at convincing me that I never belonged where I was. These are the lies our brains tell us to push happiness out of our reach. What is the evolutionary purpose of that? Is happiness stagnation? Maybe. Maybe life, all life, not just human life, is nothing more than wanting something and being able to go for it. What is life with no want? Satisfaction sounds lovely, but evolutionarily, it was apparently selected against. What I'm trying to say is that the more time that passed, the weirder I felt about initiating contact between me and any of the group. Maya's text to me from a dressing room at Cowtown had felt like a gift, a mystery, and a cosmic mistake all at the same time. I never stopped feeling like being the first to send a text would be intruding upon the real main characters of the story. Even right now as I write this, I feel like they just invited me to tell my part of the story because they wanted to be nice to me. Which is ludicrous because the things that happened to me over these months were both intense and absurd. It's a great story. It's just the rut my mind gets stuck in. God, I talk too much, I'm sorry. The point is that Before I sent off my application, I felt like I needed to talk to someone. But I didn't know who to call, and I felt really weird about it. Finally, after pacing in my apartment, I called Andy.
"Miranda,"
he answered. He didn't sound right. It was almost like he was resigned, definitely stressed, like he had begrudgingly accepted the reality that I was calling him on the phone. "Are you okay?"
"Yeah, yes. I'm sorry, I'm great. I just got off stage, so I'm a little amped. It's good to hear your voice."
The weirdness was gone, or he was just hiding it better. But his voice still sounded echoey. "Thanks, you too. Where are you?" He was always somewhere.
"Ken, just finished giving a talk at a fancy thing for rich people. Hey, I went on a date."
"What?" This conversation wasn't going how I'd planned.
"I like her. She's really nice. I wanted to tell you that before it got weird. I don't know why it would be weird, but I guess I just made it weird all by myself, didn't I? It's not serious or anything. She's just someone I met."
He left that trailing off like he was maybe going to tell me more, but then decided not to. Andy and I had never done stuff, but I had been interested at one point, and I think he had been as well. I don't know if those points had ever overlapped, but if they did, or if they still were, I didn't know how to tell.
"That's great. What's her name?" "Becky, but she goes by Bex, like with an X."
"That's pretty cool."
"She is much cooler than me,"
he explained. "That's not that hard." We chuckled together, and I felt like I was at least doing a good job of pretending like we were equals.
"So what's up?"
he asked. "Well, this is going to sound weird after your report, but, like, I have not been on any dates. Instead, I am seriously considering applying for a job at Peter Petrowicki's new laboratory, which I believe is building brain-machine interfaces that are several generations beyond what has currently been built. I want to go work there so I can find out what they're doing."
"And what will you do once you find out what they're doing?"
He seemed so confident. A lot of new responsibility came at him after April disappeared, and he seemed to be handling it really well. But that meant he was a little less fun now and more earnest. I think a lot of times people become who we need them to be. I wasn't like that, but Andy was.
"I don't know," I said, a little flustered. "I guess that depends on what it is. It could be anything. I just want to have an eye on that dude. Also, it's what I'm researching here. Kinda. And it's a really big deal. Part of me actually wants to be involved."
Andy was quiet for a long time, and then finally responded.
"You have to be very careful. This is almost certainly industrial espionage that you're talking about here.
Why do you think I called instead of texting? Fewer records."
"Fuck, Miranda, how long have you been thinking about this?"
"A while. I'm scared, though. I think I called you to talk me out of it." He laughed then.
"Well, maybe in spite of my better judgment, I'm not going to do that. You have to go."
"Why?"
"I can't,"
he stammered.
"I mean, I don't know. It's just a gut feeling. This isn't over."
"What do you mean?"
"Something strange is happening. I think it might have something to do with April."
He said it fast, like he wanted to get it out before he stopped himself. I did not respond quickly.
"Andy, it's not just that either. I think that Carl's leaving, I think that wasn't the end. I think it was the beginning."
"The beginning of what?"
"I don't know. But if you think Peter is working on something big, I think we need to know about it. I think you need to go.
I hit send on the application.
Well, I guess we'll see how that goes.
It did not go how I expected.
Andy scamped. January 5th at 2:30 p.m. I wanted today to only be a day of good feelings, and it was. It was, until I was woken up with the news. I'm pulled in two directions right now. The first is that I do truly believe that human cruelty is the exception, not the norm. This is so important to remember. But the other is that these things are happening more and more. Yes, each one is just one person, and no, their actions never make sense. But this is part of a broader trend in disconnection. It almost never ends this way, but almost never is becoming more and more common. We are disconnected from each other, and we are losing all our old ways of feeling like we matter. That tears people up inside. Usually, they act inwardly, but sometimes they lash out and hurt the people who are close to them. Even less often, they hurt strangers. Does it help to know that? Maybe not. Maybe it only helps to know that we are all part of something great. And that's the danger of acts like this. Not only is it, in part, a symptom of a loss of faith in the human story, but it also perpetuates that loss of faith. I haven't lost it, though. In response to this, please share a story that keeps your faith in people strong. I have thousands, but I want to hear yours.
Maya. After I was reasonably sure that I didn't look like a complete crumbling mess, I left the dressing room. The kind woman from the booth came over as I exited.
Honey, are you okay?
Yes, I said, barely making eye contact. Do you know where the nearest ATM is?
Sure, it's out by the cow.
The cow?
The big red cow, outside?
She replied, like it was obvious. Oh, of course, the cow. I went and got as much money as I could get out of the ATM. $600, $200 at a time. And then I went back to the vintage dress place. This is very weird and a lot to ask, I said when I got there. But there is a vendor that is selling something I would like to buy, but he does not want to sell it to me.
Well, that doesn't sound like Cowtown. The whole point is that everything is for sale. If it isn't here, you don't need it.
I don't think it's a matter of the thing, more a matter of... I trailed off, looking down, half playing it up, half still really feeling it.
Are you saying? She whispered.
Look, I don't want to make a big deal out of this.
Who was it? Al Johnson, I bet. She interrupted in a whisper.
It was the guy selling the crystals and fossils just a few tables down.
I honestly have no idea who he is. It's a big market, she said at full volume.
So what I was wondering is if you could go and buy all of the smooth white things he has. They're really pretty, like opals or pearls, but light, like plastic. Also, if maybe you could ask him where he got them and play it up like they're really valuable and you're getting a deal, and if by any chance he could get his name and the name of his business. She looked skeptical.
Why would I pretend like they're valuable? That's just gonna bring up the price.
I took out a wad of 20s and said, I don't know if they're valuable, I just want him to think they are. There's $600 here, keep whatever you don't spend. She looked at me like I was a little nuts, which, fair, but she took the money.
Well, I don't see how this hurts anybody, she said. And you'll watch the shop while I'm gone?
You'll only be 30 feet away, and I'm not going to think you're racist if you take your cash box with you. I'll think you're a prudent businesswoman. That was true. For all she knew, this could be some kind of elaborate scam.
Oh, I said, and once you buy them, tell him you'll buy as many more of them as he can find.
And that's all it took. She was off. Less than 10 minutes later, she was back.
I got them all. He wanted to keep one of them, but I upped the price until I got all four. She handed me the bag. I had to fight every instinct not to bargain more, but I think he thinks there's something special. But I got them for $180, so I can't keep all your money. She started to pull some cash out of her pocket. No, I realized I didn't know her name. Clara, she said kindly. Clara, I'm Maya. I don't know how to explain it to you, but what you did for me today was worth way more than the $420. I was smiling. I couldn't stop. I needed to put my hands on those rocks again. That can't be true, dear. It can be, and it will be extra worth it if you tell me everything you found out from that man. He was perfectly nice to me. We talked some about the market and how business was going. He lives outside Philly, and he says he bought these from his brother-in-law and doesn't know where his brother-in-law got them. But honestly, that's vendor code for I don't want to tell you where I got these. But when I told him I'd buy as many as he could find, his eyes did light up a little. I chatted him up a bit. He does cable and internet repair for his day job. This was not new information to me, but I tried not to show it. Did you get his name? Oh, yeah. He gave me his business card. It's in the bag. I opened it up. The rocks were wrapped in tissue paper, and indeed, there was a business card sitting on top of them. Just thank you, I said, giddy with the success. It finally felt like something was happening. Thank you, sweetie. And she winked at me. I went and got a hot sausage sandwich. I sat down at a picnic table and dumped the stones out. They twinkled up at me like they were alive, like they had plans for me. Someone sat down at the table, and I scooped the stones back into the paper bag. You're Maya. I looked up and saw a guy in his 30s with dark styled hair and Oakley glasses perched on top of his head. I am, I said skeptically. I remember you from April's videos. I wasn't in any of April's videos, so this was one of the most terrifying things he could have said to me. He knew who I was, and he was lying about how. I tried to act calm. Look, I'm just here to eat my hot sausage, then I'm headed home. Did you do some shopping? He continued, not taking the hint. A little. I started wrapping up my sandwich. What'd you buy? Just a bracelet. I lied. I'll buy it from you, he told me. What? The bracelet. I was standing now. He continued. $500. I don't know what you think is happening right now, but none of this makes any sense, and I'm going to go. Okay, he rushed. I'm sorry, this is going different than how I expected. Yeah, well, same, I said, backing away from him. Let me explain. For some reason, I stopped. It was weird enough that I did want an explanation. I do an alternate reality game. It's called Fish. Do you know what RGs are? Yeah, sure, I said. I was roughly familiar with folks who paid a monthly subscription for clues to be dropped into their lives. Well, I got a text from Fish saying that if I found you and got you to give me what you bought at Cowtown, that I would advance 2 levels instantly. So, can I have it? No, I said. 1,000, he said. No, it's not a price thing. This is just weird and I don't like it. 10,000. He was taking out his cell phone like he was going to Venmo me 10 grand. No, and stop asking. His frustration was turning to anger now. Just let me buy it. It's a good deal. He was at least 6 inches taller than me, and every step I took back, he moved forward into. His hand reached out for the bag, and adrenaline pumped into my body. I panicked, threw my hot sausage sandwich at his face, and ran back into Cowtown. I ran through the booths, jumping around and dodging people, not taking time to look behind me until I was halfway through the massive building. When I looked back, the Oakley's guy was nowhere to be seen. I started walking more normally now, afraid people would be suspicious, but I was also winded,
Fitness was never my focus. Another guy locked eyes on me. This guy was middle-aged with his dark hair close-cropped where it wasn't balding. "Are you Maya?" he asked. I was still catching my breath, so I did not reply, about to start running again. "You buy something at the market today?" he asked. I took off as fast as I could, which is not particularly fast, but I did not stop until I got to my truck. I hit the push-button starter on the rental and did everything I could not to drive too erratically out of the Cowtown parking lot. I considered just driving home to Manhattan, but the rocks sitting in their little bag on the passenger seat were whispering to me. Something was happening, and I couldn't give up now. Plus, as I drove in circles, trying to find out if someone was following me, I got an idea. Now a note, because it feels necessary. When we think about the first anniversary of the arrival of the Carls, we mostly think about that shooting. But really, the whole day was a pretty good and normal day until that evening. Yeah, people were mad on the internet. And yes, there were a couple skirmishes at a parade, but it only takes one person shooting their way into a nightclub to change the story. We gave everyone in America that power when we decided that basically anyone can buy an assault rifle. I don't pretend to understand the motivations of these shooters, but ultimately, it has to be a little bit about power, right? They've been convinced that having power is how you measure your worth. And they're sad or angry or, as is so often the case, both. And they see that there's one way they can definitely change the world. They've seen a dozen other guys do the same thing, so why not them? I hate that I even have to write about it here, because ultimately, billions of people decide every day to be decent and kind. But one person decides to be powerful for a moment, and now I have to talk about it or people will be like, "What about the shooting?" Well, what about it? It happened. It was terrible. Why did it happen? Was he a defender? Was it ultimately about the Carls? No. Those are all the wrong questions. It's so tempting, even now, to try to blame all of the politicians and pundits who are rising in power by feeding on people's fear and confusion. We can blame those people, but the only thing a mass murder means is that we've made it too easy to kill. None of us are going to talk about it anymore in this book, because if we did, that man will get to keep having his power on us. And I'm sick of it. Moving on.
Andy. I couldn't stop feeling bad about telling Miranda she had to apply at Altus. My gut was all, absolutely not. She should stay in Berkeley where it was normal and safe. Enough of my friends had done weird, risky things. If the book hadn't told me to tell her to do it, I absolutely would not have. It was one thing putting my money on the line with this thing, but this was Miranda's future. But the Book of Good Times was in charge now. Or maybe I just wanted it to be. And now, since I had completed the book's two requests, I could turn the page. You waited. Excellent work. I knew you would. I mean, I literally knew it. Otherwise, how could I have known when I printed the book? You probably shouldn't worry too much about all of this right now. So, you have another $1 million. It seems like you can trust me, right? As previously noted, this wasn't true. I was doing everything I could to not trust the book. I knew it was powerful, but I did not know what it wanted. So now, I'd like you to move 100% of your portfolio into Posthiker, a distributed shipping company. They've only been publicly traded for about a year, and people are not optimistic about how their business has gone. But they're about to have a very good quarter. Search for Posthiker on Twitter, and you'll see people talking about it. It's functioning. It's earning people money, and it's saving others money. The stock is going to jump 32% in the exuberance immediately afterward. Yes, I realize that I'm asking you to go against your instincts here, but you're going to need a lot of money. I know you think you already have a lot of money, but you're going to need much more. After Posthiker, you'll want to move everything into Alphabet, which will give you a further 6% bump after their earnings come in. and then after that, into Emerson, which has been doing extremely good business in air conditioners in China. The book continued this way for more than a page, instructing me exactly how to move my money over the next 2 weeks. There was some action to take almost every day. It was hard not to enjoy this plan. Not knowing what to do with my money had been stressful, but now I knew exactly what to do. It was a good feeling to know that I might soon be very, very rich. At the same time, it was terrifying to know that I was going to need it for something. After this, you will be, by my best guess, at $125 million. You're going to wonder what all of this money is for, but do your best not to worry about it. You might ask, why don't I just go to Vegas and you could tell me how to bet in roulette or which lottery numbers to pick or which sports teams to bet on? Well, it turns out those things are actually random. Nothing is as easy to guess as the success of companies. All of the data are already out there. The information is known by people and stored in computers, and the reactions of those buying the stocks are easy to predict in large part because many of those entities are deeply simplistic computer programs. The question you're asking yourself now is this illegal? Yes, it is super illegal. You are trading stocks based on tips from someone with insider information. I am stealing that information and giving it in a distilled form to you. So yes, this is illegal. But it is not, as far as I can tell, wrong to do it in this case. You do many things that are illegal, but I will not ask you to do anything that is wrong. Here is the thing about having $125 million. If your portfolio increases by 1% in any given day, your net worth will increase by $1.25 million. You will make and lose more money in a single day than many people do in their whole lives. And you will make more than you lose. You will make more money by investing your money than you ever could working. Which is fine because I don't think you're doing what you're doing to make money, except for the times when you are. I'd suggest stopping that. Though don't lose that business card. I thought about this and realized the book probably meant the card the guy had given me in Cannes. In the next 3 weeks, you need to think more than you act and listen more than you talk. There are big things happening, and you are uniquely positioned to see them. Call Bex. Introduce her to Jason. Hang out. See where it goes. As I read, I could tell it was coming to an end, and without a single word about April. Give yourself time to think. Don't fill it all up with podcasts and TV shows. Talk it out. Think it out. Be present. And maybe call Maya. She's thinking a lot these days, too. Actually, you should reach out to all the old friends. Just ask how they're doing. You've got a few weeks before this story starts up again. You can move to the next page 2 weeks from today. But remember, tell no one about me. It will ruin the good times. The urge to turn the next page was overwhelming. Where was April? What was going on? I turned the page. Andy, I told you not to turn the page. April will be okay, but sometimes you have to wait. I threw the book across the room and it slammed into the wall, knocking a couple plastic cups off my shelf. You okay in there? Jason said, half laughing. I'm fine, just trying to kill a roach. I went over to grab the book and stuffed it between my bed and the box spring. Jason did never come in my room, so I wasn't hiding it from him as much as I was hiding it from myself. And thus, in secret, I had to live all by myself in a world in which April was alive and books could predict the future. It took gargantuan strength for me not to tell Robin about it. It wasn't just that I wanted to tell anyone, though I did. It's more that it seemed so cruel to let him just suffer while I had this new hope. But then again, maybe it was cruel to tell him when it could still all be a lie. It was one thing to let a supernatural garbage book give you hope that your dead friend was alive. It was another thing entirely to force that ambiguity on someone else. I tried to take the book's advice, to give myself space to think. But I was nervous and skittish and addicted to content. Jason definitely noticed something was up. Dude, I don't want you to take this the wrong way, but you've been weird since you met Subway Girl. Don't call her Subway Girl, I told him. That's what I've always called her, though. Yeah, but she's going to come over tonight, and if you call her Subway Girl in front of her, she's going to stab you, and then me. You can call her Becky or Rebecca or Bex. Okay, he said before repeating. Dude, I don't want you to take this the wrong way, but you've been weird since you met Becky. It's not her, it's... I decided to do a half lie. It's money. Money's so freaking weird, man. Like the part where you're filthy rich and never have to worry about it again? Jason didn't really have to worry about money either. The podcast was making tons of ad revenue now, and he still had a full-time job doing database design for an e-commerce company. You totally have to worry about money when you have it, just in a different way. This was, in fairness, something I never would have said to anyone but Jason, who I was sharing about $30,000 in podcast revenue with every month. Still, he rolled his eyes pretty hard. You could buy a penthouse apartment in Midtown and not have a mortgage. Right, so should I do that? Or should I start a business? Or should I invest in the stock market or in bonds? Like, why do you think I still live here with you? Are you saying that you still live with me just because you don't know how to make a decision? Jason, I still live here because I want to. I don't want to live in a penthouse apartment in Midtown. I don't want a boat. Robin keeps making me all this money, but what's the point of it? I can't even take a girl to a fancy restaurant because it just feels like bragging. So, like, why have money? Should I just give it away? Jesus, Andy, not everything's a crusade. Just make the money while you can. Buy some cool sneakers, and then you can do good with it when you aren't so busy making it. The trick is to not spend it all on dumb shit, and, like, you're clearly physically incapable of that. You can't even find a girlfriend who wants you for your money. She's not my girlfriend. I was being defensive because I was hoping maybe she would be someday. I wasn't talking about Bex. I was talking about your inability to find a girlfriend. Ah, well, I concede. But I'm still worried I'm not doing the right thing with the untapped energy in my savings account. Well, I'll keep my eyes open for weird or good shit you can do with your money. But you're fucking lucky I'm so understanding, because most people would not sit here and listen to you complain about how hard it is to be so ludicrously rich. I am ludicrously rich, I said, smiling. Isn't it nice? Yeah, I guess it is. Sometimes I feel like I must have earned it. Sometimes I feel like I must be worth it, like I won life. But that's bullshit. April earned this money. I'm just making it. Oh my God, you are the worst. Okay, sorry. Sometimes I feel like April earned this money and I'm just making it. Better, but still bad. I think I'm good at looking like I have things together on the outside. But that's only because I spend an immense amount of time worrying about it. The book seemed to know what I should do. Well, isn't that what we all want to know? Free will is stressful. I invited Bex over to play games, just like the book said I should, and it was actually fun. I was worried that she and Jason wouldn't get along, but it turns out she was used to people who don't share a lot of the same experiences as her. We played a game that my parents and I used to play when I was a kid. You pick a long word that you can divide into three different words and describe it using definitions of its three different parts. That was probably really confusing. Example, if you pick dictionary, you say, at first, I am a penis. Then I ostracize. And finally, I'm light and free. The first person to guess dictionary wins. Bex had just bent the rules a little with, first, I am an explanation, then a vocal performance, then I weep, and finally, I am an abbreviated sibling. But we all agreed that she was a genius when the answer was how, sing, cry, sis. and that led us into talking about the reasons why housing had become so unaffordable, which devolved mostly into me and Jason repeating stuff we'd learned from one of the Threads videos. I mean, you two sound really smart, but really you just watch the Thread, Beck said after we'd gone on for 5 or 6 minutes.
Oh, you just got called out so hard, Jason said to me.
So did you.
Yeah, but Bex isn't my friend. She knows nothing about me. So I am free from the deeper ramifications of this call-out. Also, I told you not only white dudes watch the Thread.
I didn't say only white dudes, I said, thankful that the subject was moving away from my intellectual plagiarism, but apprehensive that it was moving toward race. I said mostly white dudes.
I agree. His audience is definitely mostly white dudes, Beck said. But I hate to say it, it's beneficial in this country to keep an eye on what the white dudes are doing.
We all had a laugh. Jason thought up the next clue for our game. It was I Dent Titty. It was a fun night, and as we were wrapping up, I couldn't help but think back to the Book of Good Times, which seemed to think that maybe something might happen between me and Bex. I looked up and saw Jason looking at me.
Well, I'm gonna turn in, he proclaimed.
Then he marched over to his room and firmly closed the door. I turned to Bex, embarrassed, and gave a little smile that was meant to be both apologetic and charming. So, that's Jason.
I love him, she said.
I'm glad. I was worried. He isn't the most sensitive guy. She rolled her eyes at that, but then just said,
You guys have weird fun, but it was fun. Thank you for having me over.
She stood up, and I immediately stood as well, suddenly intensely nervous. Can I walk you to the train? I asked.
No.
She came over to me and put her hands on my shoulders.
But I would like it if you kissed me goodnight.
Every nerve in my body sparkled like I was a damn high schooler as my fingers moved around her waist, and we kissed.
Miranda. Miranda, thank you for taking the time for this. I'd gotten an interview for the job. It was over some corporate video conferencing software that I had to download for the interview. I'd dressed up and pulled my most identifying feature, my bright red hair, back in a tight ponytail. I had stopped short of dyeing it. That seemed too obvious a ploy. Of course, I am so fascinated by what you are up to, I told them honestly. I'm Dr. Everett Seeley. This is my colleague Tom. I work in the lab. He's an HR manager. Remember how all of the rats in my lab were named Tom? Tom did not remind me of them. He was handsome, in his mid-30s, with wavy dark hair. Dr. Seeley, on the other hand, was shaved to his scalp everywhere his slightly elongated head wasn't naturally bald.
We were excited to see your application,
Tom continued.
Your research looks right up our alley. Can you tell me a little bit about why you're interested in working at Altus?
In my resume, it just looked like my PhD had been taking a while, not like I'd taken a year off. That wasn't technically a lie. I had gotten through my PhD program relatively quickly, so it wasn't unusual that I would still be working on my thesis. I'd just left out the part about how I had quit temporarily to become the CEO of a startup with famous people for a year. That was the kind of thing that would look really good on a resume for pretty much any job except this one. Well, I started, sounding a little shaky. If you'll excuse the impertinence, I can tell by who you're hiring what you're working on. It is also what I'm working on, except it seems that you've gotten further down the path. I can only make guesses what the steps you've taken are, but they've left me both intensely curious and also less interested in my own work. My cortisol response was kicking in hard. Elevated heart rate, sweaty pits, sudden urge to pee, all of it. I know the secret to lying is telling the truth, and it was definitely helping, but it was still terrifying. These people were not to be messed with. Simply, it seems to me that you're where the cutting edge is. Dr. Seeley picked up here.
You are, however, in the middle of your thesis project, correct?
Yes, I'd be putting that on hold. I've already discussed it with my advisor. This was a lie.
And how does he feel about that?
Tom asked. I decided not to correct him. Dr. Lundgren sees the excitement of the opportunity and understands. I know I'm taking a risk, but even if I'm not able to return to defend my thesis, it seems certain that this will be the better path for me.
You know we tried to recruit Constance,
Dr. Seeley said, using Professor Lundgren's first name.
She's a magnificent scientist. But she...
He paused. Tom continued more smoothly.
She turned us down.
She hadn't just turned them down. She told me that she'd told them to go fuck themselves. He seemed to be waiting for me to say something. I should have known better than to bring up Dr. Lundgren. I took control back with an argument I'd prepared. I don't know the details of what you're up to, but you do. So the question I have is what you would suggest I do, knowing what you know. Would you tell a young scientist to finish her PhD? Or would you tell her to work at Altus?
I'd tell her to go work at Altus,
Dr. Seeley replied. The business guy spoke up again then.
Just to be absolutely clear, the work we are doing is very secret and very sensitive. Do you have any potential ulterior motives for working here?
Was he outright asking me if I was signing up specifically for espionage? I was a terrible liar. What the hell was I doing? I heard my own voice talking, and it sounded relaxed. I just can't not be there. I'm up all night thinking about it. I had found a truth I could tell. The rest of the interview was standard. We talked about how we solved interpersonal problems at the lab, about my experience being managed and working with undergrads, and about my research at Berkeley. They seemed impressed by me, and to be honest, I was impressed by them. They were experts, they were well paid, and they seemed like good, effective communicators. Tom seemed like a bit of a tech bro, but Dr. Seeley was exactly the kind of guy I'd get along with in a work setting. He was considerate, thoughtful, and none of his jokes were at the expense of other people. They weren't scary at all. You always want to go into an interview with one or two questions for the people who are interviewing you. It's a signal that you want to make sure they're worth your time and talent. And it puts the power a little bit in your hands. Not too much, just enough for them to know that you're not desperate. Don't take this the wrong way, but what percentage chance would you guess your business has of not being around 5 or 10 years from now? I asked near the end of our allotted time. They both laughed.
Zero,
the business guy said. I waited for a reply from Dr. Seeley.
Not zero,
he said.
All probabilities are non-zero, but very, very small. This could be a lifelong job if you want it to be.
That's very good to hear, I said, smelling the hint of truth in my lie. Interview over, I needed to have a conversation with Dr. Lundgren. If I was going to leave, I needed to know what we were going to do about my research. I messaged her to see if she could come by my lab station when she was free to talk about something important. I wanted to have the conversation on my territory, not hers. A few hours later, I heard a knock on my counter. That's how we kept from sneaking up on each other. She looked good.
Everything okay, Miranda?
I figured it would be easy to say it all at once, so I just straightened up, looked her in the eyes and said, I had a job interview today with Altus. They're going to call you for a reference? Probably. I want to talk about what you might say to them.
I'm going to tell them the truth.
My eyes fell. A pit opened up in my stomach, and I slouched into it.
I'll tell them that you are a genius scientist and communicator, that you work extremely hard, and are passionate, and are always solving problems fast and well. I might leave out some facts, like, for example, that you hate them. I had never imagined that this conversation would go so well. She looked concerned, but also deeply supportive. I let out a sigh as my back muscles unclenched. Thank you, Dr. Lundgren. Oh God, thank you. What are you doing, Miranda? I have to go to Puerto Rico. I can't not go. Did I imagine talking with you in my office and both of us agreeing that these people are trash people? No. Do you still think they're trash people? I think that if I'm not there, they'll be even more trash. I was getting defensive. She was quiet for a second, and then pulled up a stool and sat. I can't tell you what to do, and I'll support it, but I need you to tell me why. Whatever they're doing, they're going to do it with or without me. Maybe I can have them do it in a less garbage way. And if I can't, or I find out something really bad, maybe I can tell people about it. She was quiet for a really long time. Miranda, that is a huge thing you are asking of yourself. I am not young anymore, but I remember being your age, and I am not going to tell you to put a lid on that ambition. But it's going to be hard to pull against their culture as it pulls on you. It will be very hard not to fall into their version of the story. But what worries me more than that is what happens if they find you out. There is a lot of money on the line here, a lot. I don't know what these people are really like. They could blackball you. You probably would never work in pharma again. Or they could dig up dirt on you, lie about you. Maybe even worse things than that. I thought back to my job interview. They did not seem like henchmen who would ruin a person for sharing industrial secrets, but I also had never met a hench person, so what did I know? Miranda? I must have zoned out for a second. I don't care. I did care. She smiled with a hint of mischief. Good. Am I getting the job? I could barely believe that it was a possibility. They had lots of candidates, and they'd find out that I was April's friend and disqualify me, but Dr. Lundgren was talking about it like it was going to happen. I think you are, and I think you're going to leave. And I'll keep your lab station open until you come back. What if I don't come back? Something is telling me you will. But this is going to be hard. Probably much harder than you think. It seemed like she suddenly wasn't just supporting a decision she didn't necessarily agree with. She was actually encouraging me. That was making all of this feel much more real. I don't know that I've even really made up my mind yet. Oh, you have. You just don't quite know what a made-up mind looks like. I didn't understand what she meant. But I left it alone and said, I won't be allowed to tell you what I'm working on, but would it be okay if I did that anyway? That would be a serious crime. And honestly, yes, I want you to do that. What? Even if they aren't doing anything iffy? Miranda, she said, leaning toward me. These people are dangerous and they're moving too fast. I'm terrified that they're doing human tests without proper clinical trials. I think they've figured out something powerful and dangerous. If I could find someone I want to put that level of faith in, it would be someone like you, not someone like Peter Petrowicki. You have the perfect background. They need people who have worked on neurocontrol interfaces, and there aren't that many of you in the world. I think we're the only ones who can do this. That could end our careers, though. You were the one just telling me how dangerous this is. We could go to prison. I'm ready for the risks. I just wanted to make sure you knew what they were.
I had known Dr. Constance Lundgren for almost 6 years now. And this was not behavior I had come to expect from her. Is everything okay with you?
You think I'm acting strange? Maybe I am. Maybe I've been playing it too safe. Remarkable things don't get done by people waiting for the status quo to crawl along.
But we're not doing a remarkable thing. We're trying to slow them down from doing something remarkable too fast. Her eyes got big, and she literally reached out and grabbed my arm. That, she said too loudly for the conversation, leaning close to my face. That right there, that is it. You found it in your own mind. That voice that tells you that the only way to do something amazing is if it's big and flashy and all yours. Turn it off. She was honestly scaring me a little. Her voice got quiet again, but the urgency remained. That obsession with impact is an infection, and it's getting worse. Altus wants to make it worse. You're going to Puerto Rico so that you can protect us from ourselves. Do you know what I think the most amazing thing the human race has ever done is? It isn't the weapons we've built, and it certainly isn't the weapons we've used. It's the weapons we haven't used. Idiots like Peter Petrowicki talk all the time about self-control, about how they carry the burden of changing the world on their shoulders. But they do that with an ambition turned in on themselves. They want to be the voice and the face and the mind behind the change. In truth, they have no self-control at all. They are slaves to their ambitions and to their need to feel admired. The truest strength is shouldering the burden of care. Is that a quote? It sounded like a quote. Do you get what I mean? I think I do. What I want to say is that often, restraint is far more remarkable than action. So don't let it not amaze you because, Miranda, you amaze me. Start wrapping up your work. You're going to get that job. While I was waiting to see if that was true, I was lucky to have a new side project. A package had arrived from Maya. Miranda, the day I texted you about that dress, which I bought BTW, I found something weird. Here is one of them. I don't even know what to call it exactly. Maybe it's just some plastic costume thing, but I have reason to believe that it's important. I kept three others here. If there's anything you can tell me, text me as soon as you know absolutely anything about them, even if it's just that they're weird. Anyway, I hope things are going well in California. Maya. Out of the padded plastic envelope fell a gorgeous hunk of something with a low density and a high thermal conductivity. That was strange enough, but there was something different about it that most people would just say was weird, but that I didn't have too much trouble putting my finger on. This stuff was hard. With a few quick tests, I had a range I could place it in. It was less hard than a diamond, which was good, because otherwise I would have had to drop everything and start a lab just to study it, but significantly harder than steel. It was more like high-performance ceramics, except it was definitely not ceramic. After only a half hour of poking and prodding, I had plenty of information to text Maya. But I kept poking. Another half hour after that, I realized I was putting texting her off. I never really got to figure out what that night between me and April meant. It was a one-time thing, but I didn't know if it was going to stay that way. It was, This is all very personal, and I feel weird about talking about it in a story that is about, like, saving human civilization, but it was my first time with a woman. It was a really big deal for me because of that. And also because it was April May. I had never completely gotten over her celebrity. I got the feeling that our night together was not a big deal for April. But I felt like Maya and I should talk it through, maybe. The way she didn't ever seem open to that made me feel like it was because she had written off any possible real friendship with me. Anyway, I thought through all our history, and then I just swallowed it and texted Maya. That stuff is weird. Too weird. Nothing has been that weird since Carl. I'm going to keep investigating. But only because it's interesting. Not because I think I'm going to find out anything that will be helpful to you. She wrote back a few minutes later. Thanks. I'm going to try to track down where it came from. I stared at the text, trying to glean meaning from it. The more time I took, the more it seemed like the kind of text I would write to my worst enemy. After an eternity of staring, I mustered up the courage to text her back. Okay, I'm trying to get a job at Peter Petrowicki's lab, so if I disappear, it's probably because I'm in Puerto Rico. My phone rang immediately. It was Maya. My heart started pounding. This was scarier than interviewing with Altus. Hello? I asked tentatively. Explain yourself. I did my best to do that. I think I was complete, though I wouldn't say I was articulate. And you think this is the kind of thing that Miranda Beckwith would do? She demanded. Or is it the kind of thing April May would do? God damn. No one had put their finger on that part of it yet. I think it's the kind of thing I'd do. It's not. But it's science? Everything I said was coming out as a question. This is about April, and that's fine. But I need you to say that to me. It's about the science and about April. It's about figuring out what this fucker is doing and taking him down if I can. And it's about figuring out who I am and what the world is without her. She was quiet for a while and then said, I think we're all figuring out who we are without her. I'm sorry, I blurted out. She replied immediately. For what? Oh, God. Which thing to say first? That we couldn't protect her, and also that I slept with her. You hooked up with April? My brain was yelling, fucking idiot! But I replied quietly, oh, I thought you knew. She laughed. Jesus, is that why you've been so weird around me? I thought you just didn't like me. I didn't know what to say. She continued, Miranda, if I wasn't friends with anyone April hooked up with in college, I wouldn't have had many options. The fact that April hooked up with you in no way makes me think less of you. We weren't together. She's hot and charming. Do you still have feelings for her? No, I rushed to tell her. I mean, I miss her. I don't know, Maya. I'm just so confused. My mind was working more slowly than my mouth. You understand yourself. I don't even know if I'm gay. Or a lesbian. Or bi? Am I bi? I'm 25 years old. How do I not know this about myself? When she spoke, which wasn't immediately, her voice had become so gentle that it almost felt like a different person. If I were with you, I would hug you so hard right now. I'm sorry. We're all going at our own speed. I was crying now. And through my tears, I asked, why are you being so nice to me? Miranda Beckwith, you take that back. I'm being nice to you because I like you. And you're a good person. And we're friends, and we're both grieving April. Now it sounded like she was crying too. How did we get here? I asked. I was just trying to tell you about Altus. Right, well, that is also important. Listen, Peter was always appealing to a lot of people. The thing that he tapped into didn't go away. It just lost its name. People are still killing each other over this. He's a bad guy, but he built up his connections and he's made it into value for himself. But I don't see what you can do about it. I'm going to go if I can. I have to. But maybe I won't be able to, I might not get the job.
You'll get the job.
Everyone seemed convinced of this except me.
But look, you're not April. Don't take stupid risks like April.
That made me feel like she cared about me, which made me feel really good. And the fact that it made me feel good made me feel silly for caring so much. I am not April. I will not take stupid risks like April. I was getting better at lying.
At user uncertain. I cannot tell you anything about fish, except that at peak, I spent 60 hours a week working on solving it. And even so, I am frustrated I didn't work harder. This will change the world.
Maya. Helping Miranda was the most normal and wonderful and real thing I had done in months. There's nothing like being needed by someone. Relationship drama, friends sleeping with exes, that was stuff I had experience with. It felt important, but also normal. I think we're all ultimately searching for normal, but important. Miranda also helped distract me from the new reality I was in. This reality was one where a game called Fish somehow knew where I was and had sent vaguely threatening men to acquire rocks I had bought at a place called Cowtown. Let's go back to that day. I was too frightened to go back to my Airbnb, so I just drove around, thinking and worrying. And that's when I remembered something I had done very intentionally, but had completely forgotten about. I pulled the truck off on a long stretch of road so I could see a good distance both ways, and then I took the business card out of the paper bag that held the rocks. Kurt Butler, earthforgeminerals.com, 856-294-6319. I told Clara to convince Kurt, probably has some red hats, Butler, that the rocks were valuable and tell him that she would buy as many as he could get his hands on. And if I was right, Kurt Butler would soon be trying to get more of his special rocks to sell. I didn't want to be anywhere but in a vehicle I could use to drive away from strange men anyway, so I went back to Cowtown. I waited outside of the entrance, hoping that Kurt had driven his cable repair van so I could spot him. The flea market closed at 4, so I was clear until then. I used that time to research Kurt Butler, which was fairly easy, even just with a phone. He had a very public Facebook. It was like he had actively turned off every possible privacy setting. Some posts were about geology and paleontology, and then a bunch of them were about grave internal and external threats to America. So, yeah. I didn't really care about his politics, though. I honestly didn't think Kurt, very concerned about the future of Western civilization, Butler, was some vital part of this story. I just thought he had found some rocks, and I needed to know where they came from, and he sure wasn't going to come out and tell me. While I waited, I opened up my podcast app and searched for Fish Game. It wasn't long before I was listening to Fishing with Joe and Tim, which was basically a news service for people who played the game. I quickly found that it wasn't like other RGs because you didn't have to pay for it. It started with a WhatsApp message sent seemingly at random. It requested proof that people had completed a series of increasingly bizarre tasks. The first task was always the same. You had to take a picture of yourself holding a live fish. Then maybe you'd have to record yourself telling a friend you love them or sawing a dictionary in half. The deeper you got, the weirder the tasks got, and the quieter the people completing them became online. Aside from it being free, it wasn't like other reality games in two ways. One, you could only play Fish if you got the message, and there didn't seem to be any pattern of who got the messages, except they always came through WhatsApp. Two, people who had completed the game were notoriously quiet about the later levels and seemed bizarrely enthusiastic that the rewards for completing the game were worthwhile. I was pretty infected with their unquestioned enthusiasm about the whole thing when the Cowtown parking lot finally began emptying out. At around 4:30, I spotted Kurt Butler's van as it pulled out of the lot. I followed. Kurt did not go home. nor did he go to some place where he might acquire more of the rocks. I was surprised to find that he went to a service call at a hotel in Walton. As nice hotels got nicer and cheap motels became aggressively cheaper, the Walton Motor Inn had been stranded in the middle. New awnings and a fresh paint job couldn't obscure the outdated facade, and it looked like an attached restaurant had been closed for renovations that were no longer happening. It was trying its best to be nice, but it just wasn't. Kurt's van pulled around the back to what I assumed was a service entrance. I thought about following him, but that seemed too obvious. But then, a half hour passed, and Kurt still hadn't come back out. And then another half hour. Eventually, my curiosity got the better of me. I pulled around the corner, and there was Kurt, PBS's fake news butler, in the quickly darkening evening, rummaging through a heap of detritus at the back of the hotel. As soon as I was all the way around the corner, he looked up at me. At first guilty, and then confused as our eyes locked and I assumed he recognized me. I should have stayed calm. I should have pretended like I was just witnessing a weird cable guy rummaging through a trash pile. But instead, I freaked out and hit the accelerator way too hard. I wasn't familiar with the truck. It had more kick than expected, and I was looking more at Kurt than the road. I drove into a utility pole. Kurt, familiar with utility poles and my face, then needed to make a decision. Did he get in his van and ignore maybe the weirdest thing that had happened to him in his whole life? The black girl he had messed with at Cowtown for overfondling his weird rocks snuck around the back of a sleazy hotel in a Nissan Frontier to witness him dumpster diving, only to then drive into a pole? Or did he walk over to ask if I was okay, and also, what on earth was I doing there? I didn't like my odds, so as Kurt began disentangling himself from the pile of old shelves, bar stools, and wiring, I threw the Nissan in reverse. Luckily, the truck had enough horsepower to get me off the curb. Kurt was running up to me, yelling, "Hey, what the fuck? What the fuck is going on?" I fumbled with the shifter, and then I was off, Kurt running behind me. So, good news. Kurt very probably thinks the deep state is out to get him, butler, and I did not have a physical or even verbal confrontation. Indeed, Kurt Butler, still, thank God, knew nothing about me. I could only hope that he hadn't gotten a look at my license plate, though I'm not sure what he'd be able to do if he did. I drove for half an hour, taking random turns, not paying attention to where I was going, before pulling into the parking lot of a Dunkin' Donuts to check how jacked my truck was. It was jacked enough that I spent the next hour on the phone with the rental company and my insurance company, feeling deeply incapable. But I didn't cry, and I didn't call my mom, because I'd helped lead an international movement, and damn it, I could handle a fender bender. And then I went back to the hotel, because now I knew that either, one, Kurt Butler was doing some kind of official business in a trash pile behind a gross hotel, or, two, that is where he had found the rocks. I decided that I'd start inside because I wanted to ask a question. The check-in desk had been sprayed with stucco to make it look like stone. And yes, an Egyptian eye of Horus had been pressed into the stucco, because it was Walton, so of course it had. I walked up to a check-in desk to a gray-haired man in his 50s. "Hi, I'm sorry to trouble you about this, but have you been visited by Carson Communications recently?"
"God damn it, this is the last time. We are not doing anything hinky here."
"I'm sorry?"
"You're in and out of here every week telling us that we're up to whatever, I don't know, but we're just a hotel. Our guests use the internet when it works, which it doesn't, more often than not. I'm sick of this."
He had a North Jersey accent, which I had discovered was different from the more Philly-inspired accents I heard day to day in Walton. I loved the accent, and I don't mind the lack of pretense that often comes with it. Still, I was caught off guard. "I'm sorry, I just have a friend who works for them, and he said he might be here." I thought of this lie on the fly, and I was pretty proud of it.
"Well, tell him he better not be, because we're not doing anything, and they better start solving some problems instead of accusing us of being the problem."
I'm sorry, this sounds really annoying. Can you tell me more about what they say is going on?
They say that the whole neighborhood is down because we're using too much internet. Now, I'm not saying there aren't times, like evenings, when, you know, people are watching a lot of pornos. But we've had high speed here for 20 years and nothing's changed. They even made me go through each room to make sure no one had hooked up something to steal our internet. I did it, and like I said, there was nothing. But they keep coming in, telling us that we're the reason the internet's down. Well, it's down for us too, and it's costing me customers.
I've got a good friend who runs the coffee shop in town, and they're in the same boat. Hard to have a coffee shop with no Wi-Fi. I said this mostly in the hopes that he'd keep talking.
Did they accuse him of being the problem?
No, I laughed. Well, I don't think so, anyway.
Well, that sounds nice. They're in here every week telling me I'm up to no good. I'm just trying to make a living here.
When was the last time you saw them?
A couple of weeks ago now, I guess. And then I catch the guy sneaking around the back looking through our stuff.
The cable guy?
Yeah, he was back there looking for who knows what. I've seen homeless guys do that, trying to find something to sell. But this guy's got a job. What is he doing going through our trash? You ask your friend about that, okay?
That does sound like him, actually. He's always looking for a way to make a quick buck.
Tell him to do it some other place.
My heart was pounding with the lies and the unapologetic North Jersey flair for confrontation. I decided there wasn't much more I was going to get. Well, I'm really sorry this has been so rough. I'll give Kurt a piece of my mind for you when I see him.
You do that.
I got back in my truck, drove out of view of the front windows, and then pulled around the back of the hotel. It was time to dive into that pile of detritus that Kurt, everything I don't like is a conspiracy butler, had been illicitly wading through earlier that evening. I wished I had gloves. It was cold out, and under a dusting of snow that had just begun to fall, a lot of the stuff looked broken or dangerous. It was fully dark now, so everything I saw was under the harsh glare of my cell phone flashlight. What I found was what you would expect. Trash. Two soggy bar stools with split faux leather tops, a printer, and an old CRT monitor, an ancient mop and its broken bucket, some warped plywood, a bike frame, scraps of carpet, Pop-Tart boxes, and a ton of empty water bottles. Maybe this is where the neighbors all brought their junk. But what there wasn't was anything at all that you wouldn't expect to find in a big pile of trash behind a crappy hotel. So then I decided to look deeper. It felt just the slightest bit like the dream, a shadow of that sensation of knowing that somewhere, something was waiting to be found. I lifted up a piece of splotched pink carpet and found underneath a couple hypodermic needles and a soggy old book. Nope, I said aloud and then tiptoed my way out of the mess as fast as felt safe. I couldn't help but imagine what my dad would think if he saw me in that moment. Then I got mad at myself for caring. And then I got mad at myself for giving up. I mean, it was dumb. I was at a hotel, so it was probably a Bible. But it wasn't really big enough to be a Bible. Okay, this wasn't actually like the dream. It was colder and muddier, and with a higher chance of contracting hepatitis. The weather was always so nice in the dream, and you never got tired. And you never had to talk to other people.